Welcome to the VHA Weekly Update number 7. My name is Stuart McCullough. I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting this week with community health, thank you to those members for their feedback with regards to the Social and Community Services Agreement. We'll continue to work with members to address their concerns with regards to the outstanding items of claim. With respect to the Allied Health Professionals, that agreement expired on the 30th of June 2016. To date, we're aware that three community health services have received logs of claim. Similar to last time, with regards to those logs of claim, they are largely identical with a small number of variances between those logs of claim. In particular, there are about 46 to 47 items in the logs of claim, and 9 of them are different, the rest are identical. Interesting also is that 33 of the items of the log of claims tend to reflect either acute outcomes, including some acute claims that have previously been rejected. That is, over 70% of the log reflect claims that were made in another sector. With regards to the Health Workers Union and the Health and Allied Services Agreement, we're still awaiting the development of a more succinct log of claims to assist the parties to go through the negotiation process in a more efficient manner. But you will be receiving from us a request for an authority to act, and we'll shortly provide members with NERR materials. With respect to the acute sector, regarding the nurses agreement, the nurses agreement reference group will meet shortly and discuss the key implementation issues. It may well be that some of those matters are then referred to other working parties to progress during the life of the agreement. VHAA has made submissions to the Safe Patient Care Act Task Force review. In particular, we've made submissions with respect to aged care, maternity services, and the role that technology might play in taking into account nurse-sensitive indicators and applying the ratios in a way that responds to real-time information. With regards to mental health, members will be aware that that agreement was approved at ballot by 99.2% of those who cast a valid vote. And with regards to the allied health professionals, we had a meeting the other week with regards to a couple of matters, including a claim that CPD allowance for November should be paid, notwithstanding that the new rates will encompass that payment. We've exchanged correspondences and had offered to meet, but but that invitation has not been accepted. With regards to public holidays, an issue arose in terms of the application of the existing public holiday provisions and their interaction with the national employment standards. In meeting with VAPA, they raised a concern that in some instances, those who would ordinarily have worked both the 25th, Sunday the 25th of December, and Tuesday the 27th were advised that they needed to take annual leave to get the benefit of both days. If that were the case, that is not correct. Under the National Employment Standards, where there is a public holiday, an employee is entitled to work, to not work that day, and to receive their ordinary pay. With respect to the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement, for those people who are yet to convene their Agreement Implementation Committee, should do so. We will have discussions with the HWU as to whether there's any clarifying material that might support the convening of those Agreement Implementation Committees. With respect to doctors, we have a meeting scheduled for the 24th of February with the AMA. There is then a broader reference committee that includes the department the following week. But we look forward to providing further updates with regards to these agreements and many other issues shortly. Welcome to this week's weekly update discussion, where we go in depth with regards to a particular subject of interest to VHAA members. Returning this week after his 1 week suspension is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor Tim Nagel. Tim, thank you for joining me.
It's good to be back, Stuart.
And thank you for wearing an alarmingly Donald Trump-esque tie.
Wow, yes.
Tim, would you do the honours with regards to this week's subject box?
Okay.
So for the benefit of those who may be listening to us rather than watching this this broadcast, would you be kind enough to describe to the listeners what was underneath the box?
It is an album, the Everly Brothers, and a hammer.
Which means the subject is what?
record-breaking mystery boxes.
Record-breaking, that is a very fair assumption. I did feel as though my clues were being a little bit too abstract and not enough information, so I've tried to overcompensate this week by providing two clues, the first of which are the Everly Brothers, that's Phil and Don Everly, who were hitmakers in the 50s and 60s with a range of great songs such as Wake Up Little Susie, Kathy's Clown, and Love Hurts. And for the Everly Brothers, love did indeed hurt, because whilst they sang beautifully together on stage, they fought dramatically off stage. And that's what our hammer represents. Our hammer represents the conflict that the Everly Brothers experienced. So today's subject is dispute settlement, which goes to the issue of resolving conflict, which would have been a great assistance to Phil and Don if they'd been covered by an enterprise agreement.
Yes, indeed.
So all of our enterprise agreements have dispute settlement procedures, but just in terms of beginning that discussion, we should take a step back and just talk about the Act a little bit and the reason why it is that we have those dispute settlement procedures.
Yeah, so in terms of the Act, I mean, one of the objectives of the Act is to enable fairness, and that's by providing mechanisms to resolve disputes. So that's listed in the objectives as one of the purposes of the Act. And it also goes on to talk about that you need to include a dispute resolution clause in agreements if they're going to be certified. That needs to provide a process to resolve disputes and grievances and also enable representation of the parties involved in those disputes.
So having regard for the objects of the Act and the requirements for approval, dispute resolution procedures are included in agreements because they're required to be there.
That's right, exactly.
So in terms of turning to the agreements themselves and the new agreements that have been developed over the past few months, where will people find their dispute resolution procedures?
So it's at the front of the agreement. It's usually around Section B, and that's usually entitled something like consultation dispute resolution procedures.
So one of the things that we've been conscious of trying to do this time around is to get a greater consistency in the way that agreements are structured. So people can generally expect to find in Part B particular clauses including the dispute resolution procedure. I don't think we've got things quite identical across all the agreements, but it's moving towards a standardised format.
So we've come a long way. We haven't got to a degree where everything's exactly the same, but we're along the path.
So perfect synchronicity still eludes us, but we're getting closer.
Correct.
So people will turn to Part B of their agreement and look for their dispute resolution procedure?
Yes.
So all of our agreements have dispute resolution procedures. Tim, it's not uncommon for employers to have their own policy with regards to dispute resolution. What's the interaction between those policies and the dispute resolution procedures under an enterprise agreement?
Yeah, so so organisations can have policies on dispute resolution, but it can't undermine the agreement provision. So it can build on top of it, but it can't be inconsistent with the agreement provision.
Okay, so in terms of industrial paper, rock, scissors, the agreement prevails.
Correct.
Okay. If we turn to the clause itself and the way in which it's structured, the first subclause, which is headed resolution of disputes and grievances, the first sentence makes reference to the fact that for the purpose of that clause, a dispute includes a grievance. Why is that statement made?
Yeah, look, that's really just about ensuring that there's not an argument that a grievance isn't a dispute. They're used interchangeably. So for that purpose, it's just entitled dispute, which encompasses grievances.
So that's to avoid whenever we use the term dispute, saying dispute and or grievance.
That's right.
Because that could be extraordinarily annoying.
It would be.
I promise not to do that for the rest of this discussion. The clause then goes on to say that the procedure applies to any dispute, and silently and or grievance, arising in relation to specified matters. And it lists four items. In particular, it makes reference to any dispute arising under the agreement itself. And I guess that's a statement of the obvious that the dispute resolution procedure under the agreement should cover any dispute about the agreement.
That's right.
It also refers to the NES, any dispute arising under the National Employment Standards. Why does it do that?
What we want to be able to do is to have easy resolution of those sort of disputes. So by encompassing matters under the NES, it allows for the Commission's assistance in resolving disputes.
And from my recollection, it's one of those mandatory requirements.
That's right.
That the dispute resolution procedure must provide power to resolve disputes about the national employment standards.
The requirement of the certification process.
And we've also got two other references. One is to a flexible working arrangement, and the second of which is a request for an additional 12 months parental leave. Now, both those items actually fall under the NES, but the way in which the Act operates is it says that that those are not matters that would be covered by dispute resolution unless the agreement provides that they are.
Yes. And again, this is a matter of convenience. So that allows the Commission to, the jurisdiction to deal with those sort of matters as well.
So why create jurisdiction for the Commission to resolve disputes with regards to flexible working arrangements and requests for additional 12 months parental leave?
So the alternative to using the Commission in that dispute resolution process is the Federal Court, and of course accessibility and cost is an issue if you use that alternative jurisdiction.
Not to mention the speed at which a matter might be resolved. Mm. The Fair Work Commission has a long history of being able to resolve disputes through conciliation, and it's a far more direct way of resolving disputes rather than everybody traipsing off to court.
Exactly.
The final element with regards to that clause is perhaps a statement of the obvious, where it says that employees and employers can choose to be represented at any time during the dispute resolution procedure, and in particular it makes reference to the fact that people can be represented by a union or an employer representative such as ourselves. Just for the sake of clarity, that does not mean that employers can elect to be represented by a union or that employees can be elected to can elect to be represented by us.
No, that's true. I mean, the purpose of that is really to enable the parties the best chance to resolve disputes. And often that may include that sort of representation.
Moving on to the obligations under the provision, and I'd like to focus in particular on what I think is one of the most overlooked provisions within the dispute settlement clauses, and in particular the obligation that the parties to the dispute and their representatives must genuinely attempt to resolve the dispute through the processes set out in the clause. I think that's really the most commonly overlooked obligation under the agreement. Those are not mere words. That is an active obligation on parties to genuinely try and resolve matters. I do think it's important that requirement be complied with. Otherwise, the Commission, I don't think, has jurisdiction to resolve a dispute if the parties haven't met that earlier requirement.
No, arguably not. And I think you're right in that. Sometimes where these sort of disputes arise, people can take a position, a more combative position, when really the purpose of the clause is to try to get people to resolve the dispute.
So for many of our members, they will have received correspondence from time to time, and it would be fair to say that the correspondence they receive might have been written in combat mode.
Yes.
And it doesn't necessarily demonstrate a willingness to genuinely try and resolve the dispute.
And that's the purpose of the whole clause, is to try and get people to work through their differences as opposed to standing 10 feet apart and throwing things at each other.
Just in terms of that, it is open to members to actively refer to that provision and remind the parties that they're dealing with that they're both obliged to genuinely try and resolve a dispute.
And that's often just trying to fully explain their positions or what their thinking is, because you don't want to get into a circumstance where you haven't thoroughly talked about, well, why is there an actual difference between the two sides and what's the basis of that difference in position? Because they're the things that will enable you to actually create options for overcoming the differences.
So there are really two key elements that you've identified there, one of which is understanding what the dispute is. Sometimes that will be very, very obvious, but I think a lot of people will have received letters from time to time where it's not so obvious what the dispute is, and perhaps under those circumstances the first step has to be clarification as to what is in dispute. And the second element that you identified is identifying the basis the basis for the reason that the dispute has arisen. Mm. That is, give the parties something to work through to try and get to a resolution.
And it really can't be overemphasised how important that step is. I know my personal experience is sometimes you get into a dispute and the parties aren't really sure what the actual dispute's about. So being able to identify the exact the exact difference is really important.
It's interesting. There is a certain point with a lot of disputes where the conflict itself becomes more important than the substantive issue. And I think for practitioners, a key thing for them to bear in mind is to always take a step back and consider what the substantive issues are rather than get swept along with the conflict.
Yeah, and of course that provides the platform to resolve the dispute.
Also under the same provision, we have a common set of words that talks about work continuing normally according to the usual practice that existed before the dispute until the dispute is resolved. Those words are often referred to as the status quo provisions, notwithstanding that the words status quo don't appear as such. But there are exceptions to that requirement.
So health and safety matters are an exception to that. And I think that it's often useful for people to turn their minds about what the status quo is, notwithstanding the fact that those words aren't used, because I think often that can cause the focus of the conflict as well. So not only do you have the dispute, the original dispute, but then you have disputes about the status quo and what that may be and what has to be maintained. So I think being very clear about what the status quo is also equally important.
And not allowing that necessarily to become the new dispute.
Well, that's right. I mean, the whole purpose of that provision in the procedure is to ensure that neither party are compromised by the dispute resolution process being allowed to run its course. I think that's really important in that if people are going to cooperate to resolve the dispute, they need to be comfortable that their position is going to be compromised by that.
So one of the features of the new provisions is that it deals with the facilitation of dispute resolution, in particular the role of employee representatives. That's not new in practice, but it is new to the agreement.
And I think this overcomes some of the impediments to the resolution of process. So again, people tend to focus on other issues other than the resolution of the actual dispute. So representation's involvement in the process can be another source of distraction.
It is more common in our sector that the employee representative will commonly be a union employee as opposed to delegate, but in some instances employee delegates may fill that role.
That's correct, yeah.
So in terms of the process itself, one of the things that the agreements do is require that parties try and resolve things at the workplace level. It's quite frequent that when a dispute begins or a grievance commences, that one party or other will threaten to skip over that part of the process and go directly to the Fair Work Commission.
Yes, and again, it's a very important part of the process in that it provides an opportunity to resolve it very quickly, as opposed to then entering into the process through the Commission.
And it's really as much about the obligation is on parties to try and resolve things so that the Commission's time is well spent for those things that do require assistance as opposed to those things that don't.
Exactly.
And in terms of the time period in which that should occur, there are, under those provisions, a requirement to meet or engage with managers and the next level up, usually within a 14-day period or such longer period as may be agreed.
Yes, it needs to happen quickly. I mean, these... It can't be a source of frustration, these processes. They need to be able to be expedited as quickly as possible.
But by the same token, it gives scope to the parties to recognise certain practicalities. If a key person, such as the person who has filed the grievance, is away for 2 weeks, then there is no benefit in progressing without them.
No.
And so when matters do go through that process and can't be resolved at the workplace level, it's then, and it's only then, that parties can refer the matter to the Fair Work Commission.
Well, that's right. So the referral is really based on the premise that the parties can't resolve it themselves and they need the assistance of the Commission to resolve it.
So each agreement also contains a provision with regards to disputes of a collective character. And I think that's worth focusing on, that a dispute can be from an individual, but it can also easily be from a group.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so some disputes by their nature are collective disputes. They affect a large number of employees, just as they can affect one employee.
Now, the statements under the agreement, which have come from previous agreements, talk about the fact that sometimes early reference to the Commission might be an advantage in the case of a collective dispute. However, that doesn't provide a right to skip over the process for trying to resolve it at a workplace level, though, does it?
No, people still need to generally try and resolve disputes at the local level in the first instance. Again, there's no use having the same conversation at the commission that you could have at the local level.
So I'm mindful that of some of our members, some of our members will be very familiar with the commission, and perhaps some will be less so. One of the things that I always find fascinating is that when you're dealing with a party, particularly with a representative, about a dispute, how often that representative might threaten to take you to the commission as though that were a bad thing. But some disputes really ought to go to the commission.
No, well, that's right. I mean, the whole purpose of the dispute resolution clause, including the establishment and operation of the commission, is to resolve disputes. So really the threat is to seek assistance to resolve the dispute, which in itself isn't a threat.
It should be, in some instances, really welcomed.
That's right.
So you get to the commission and really the commission may provide you with the best opportunity by which to resolve your dispute.
Yes. So, I mean, this is the commission's bread and butter, in a sense, is that they're involved in the dispute resolution processes day in and day out. So they're well placed to assist parties resolve disputes and work through the process.
Tim, you're no stranger to the commission. I don't know if you've attended with your Donald Trump tie, but how would you prepare if you're taking a dispute to the commission?
Well, really, it's about being very familiar with what the dispute's about and what the potential options are to resolve the dispute. I mean, they're the things that are going to put you in the best position to resolve it or convince the commission about the legitimacy of your position and the range of options that are open to the parties to resolve it. The focus needs to be on the resolution.
One of the things that's changed on a procedural level, we have F10s where the person notifying the dispute sets out the points for dispute, but the ability to actually put in a reply filing an F1 form is something that is more recent.
Yes, and I think this assists the Commission more than anything, the employer as well, but it assists the Commission get an overview of what the actual dispute's about, and that places them in the best position to assist the parties. I mean, if they go into the conference only seeing or only hearing one side of the argument, then they're going to start the initial parts of the conference from understanding both sides. But if they know beforehand, then it puts them in the best position to get straight into the assistance role.
In terms of maximising the likelihood of resolution of the commission, so what we know is that most disputes that go to the commission get resolved through conciliation. What can members do if they're going to the commission to prepare?
So I think, again, it's about understanding what the dispute's actually about and being well-versed in all the facts. So that helps your side. Also, if you try and understand the other side's position and where they're coming from, because sometimes in these situations, if you understand the other side, then you can help navigate through what their objections may be. That understanding of both your side and the other side, and then turning your mind to potential resolutions.
Now, I think that's a really important point, to ensure that when you do get to the commission, you're not simply presenting an impasse, but to actively turn your mind as to what the possible resolutions could be.
Mm. And that's what the commission will do. Their interest is in trying to resolve the conflict between the parties. So if it's a mere impasse, then the conference stage is not useful. But there will always be a way to resolve disputes.
Having said that, the agreement does also provide for arbitration. However, it isn't the case that somebody can simply, one party simply decides to go to arbitration regardless of the view of the other. What are the circumstances under which arbitration might apply?
So arbitration really applies where both the parties agree that there isn't going to be a way to resolve it, and the commission is satisfied that there's no likely resolution of the issue.
There's an interesting term under the agreement where it refers to conciliation as being complete. And then the term is defined to refer to a number of circumstances, which includes conciliation is complete when the parties resolve the dispute.
That's right.
However, no arbitration is required under those circumstances.
No.
Where the parties both advise that further conciliation is unlikely to resolve the dispute, or where the commission forms a view that conciliation is unlikely to resolve the dispute, either because one of the parties has made an application or a submission to that effect, or the commission simply forms that view off its own bat.
Yes, yes. So in those circumstances, then arbitration is the next step.
Just in terms of arbitration, now sometimes in a dispute, people become quite committed to arbitration and put aside the potential of reaching a resolution. What approach do you take when arbitration is seemingly imminent?
Well, I think your point before that the vast majority of these disputes resolve at conference or conciliation. There's a very, very small percentage of disputes that ever go to arbitration. So it's really unusual for a dispute to proceed that way. For me, I think with arbitration, the outcome is somewhat unpredictable. So where I have the power or where it's possible that the dispute can be resolved in the power of the parties, I think that's the best option.
I think for me, it's also about not forgetting the possibility that a dispute may resolve even when the parties are heading towards arbitration. Sometimes people can be committed solely to that course and stop thinking about options for resolution. I think I can recall a matter that you and I were both involved in, where the matter was set for arbitration, and in the process of preparing, it became apparent there was an option for resolution, which ultimately did fix the matter.
And that was, I think that from memory, that was in the stage of doing the submissions for the arbitration. So, I mean, there's a good example of a resolution being really found at the desk door, so to speak. So it's always possible, and I think the realities of arbitration can be quite sobering for the parties. So as people get closer to that process, they can be more willing to try and find a resolution.
So the dispute resolution procedures under this round of agreements, not quite identical, but very close to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And in terms of the key points, I think it's worth us then recapping on those clauses and the key items under them.
So I think the first point is the subject matters that can be subject to the dispute resolution process.
So whether or not the particular dispute falls within the scope.
That's right.
So if you change brand of coffee, that is not a dispute that falls within the scope of the dispute resolution procedure.
That's exactly correct. The second one would be the requirement to generally try and resolve the dispute, and that goes both to the parties but also their representatives as well. The third point would be the status quo, even though it doesn't mention status quo, but how the parties preserve their options whilst the dispute's being resolved. And finally, how to prepare and how to try and resolve the dispute if it does go to conference.
So, Tim, I couldn't agree more, which means that the dispute between us, with the exception of your time, is now resolved. Thanks for joining me, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart.